In this hour of the show, we will explore the history of the right to dissent here in the United States. The guest for the program is Jeffrey Stone. He's professor of law at the University of Chicago, and we'll be talking about some of the ideas that you will find in his recent book, Perilous Times, Free Speech in Wartime, From the Sedition Act of 1798 to the War on Terrorism. It's published by W.W. Norton. And in this book, he examines six periods in American history where the nation went too far in restricting civil liberties. And very specifically, the thing he is interested in is the First Amendment and free speech. And all of these times, he points out, all of them occurred during wartime. In 1798, the Civil War, World War I and II, the Cold War, and the Vietnam War. He's here visiting the campus, and we're pleased to have him with us here in the studio. Just a little bit more about him. He is the Harry Calvin Jr. Distinguished Service Professor of Law at University of Chicago, also served as the Dean of the Law School from 1987 until 1994, and was provost of the university from 94 to 2002. He is the author or co-author of a number of other books that deal with the First Amendment, the Bill of Rights, and we're pleased to have him here. Questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Folks are invited to hear into the conversation. The only thing we ask is that people just try to be brief in their comments so that we can keep the program moving, get in as many different people as possible. But certainly anyone is welcome to call. Thanks very much for being here.
I'm delighted to be here. It's my pleasure.
What is it about wartime? Because you do indeed make the argument in the book that this has been the only time that the government has aggressively moved to restrict rights at these times. What is it about wartime that tends to create that kind of atmosphere?
Well, part of it, in particular with respect to speech, is that although civil libertarians generally think of dissent in wartime as the highest form of patriotism, because at what other time is it more important for the members of a self-governing society to deliberate about the wisdom and morality of the policies that the nation is following? And they're surprised that such criticism is labeled disloyal. But in fact, dissent in wartime can make it more difficult for the nation successfully to wage war. If an enemy knows that we are divided and uncertain, and that it's possible that we will lose our own resolution to continue the combat, then that will strengthen their will and lead them to continue to fight and to perhaps to fight more ferociously because of the belief that even if they cannot win militarily, they might be able to win in the American political system. So one reason why dissent in wartime is often seen as so threatening is that it can reasonably be perceived by people who have committed themselves to the war and believe that the war effort is necessary and just as something that simply makes it more difficult to achieve the national goal. And their desire then, their natural response is essentially to say to those who are dissenting, you're simply making it more difficult for us to achieve our ends. Shut up. And the other part that makes dissent in wartime especially vulnerable to suppression is that emotions are raw. There is ordinarily a great deal of anxiety and fear among the population. And in particular, individuals whose son or daughter, brother or sister, mother or a father might be off putting life and limb at risk fighting a war, does not want to hear that their loved one is in fact running the risk of losing life or limb in an unjust or an immoral cause. And even more so, they don't want to hear that about someone they love who already has paid the ultimate sacrifice. So that the emotions that are triggered by criticism of a war during a war, when American young men and young women are in fact at risk, tends to generate a great deal of animosity, indeed fury, and that leads to calls for suppression.
Yeah. You make the argument, if you look at the background to each of these instances, that there may be two things going on, that as you say, that in times like these, people are afraid and that they turn to their government and they say, we're afraid. This is very serious, dire times, nation is threatened, I feel threatened, do something. So there is pressure that comes from the bottom up. At the same time, there are and have been political motivations that people in the government have used, and they have used these things to get at their political opponents. So one wonders where the stronger force is. This is, in fact, a kind of a bottom-up phenomenon where government responds to people's fears, or is this something that comes from the top and it happens because someone in a position of power thinks it's to their advantage to enact these kind of policies?
Well, they generally work in tandem, and they may vary in importance from one episode to another. Sometimes the pressure is very largely a bottom-up pressure of fear or anger on the part of citizens demanding action, and government is simply responding to the demands of the citizens because it wants to demonstrate that it is capable of taking decisive action to protect the national security. Other times, at the other extreme, there are circumstances where national leaders actually manipulate public opinion so as to create a sense of fear and fury in order to achieve partisan political gain. So there is an effort on the part of political leaders to take advantage of a situation of a wartime type environment in order to leverage that situation to serve their own political goals. So both of those factors occur, and the extent to which they may mix in any given circumstance varies from one time period to the next. But they are the two primary factors that combine to create this phenomenon.
We can talk about some of these things in a little bit of detail, but first, maybe again, a kind of a general question, because one of the things that you point out is that every time this has happened, after we have looked back and regretted it, and that every time there has been this compromise, this erosion of rights, not only have we looked back and we regretted it, but we corrected that. And so the freedom rebounded, and in some cases there was afterwards even an expansion. So the question is, if we come to a situation like this today, if we're at one of these points, how worried are we, how worried should we be, given the fact that in the past these have been temporary and they have, in a sense, burned themselves out, and we have said, that was a mistake, we'll fix that, and we do.
Well, this is a fundamental point about the so-called war on terrorism. In all of these prior episodes that I talk about in the book, there is a beginning, a middle, and an end to the situation. And although what happened during the situation may be, in many respects, extremely regrettable and avoidable, nonetheless, at least it is the case that they were time-bound. And there's some consolation in the fact that to the extent these were even misguided emergency measures, at least they were temporarily in place and not permanent. Now, if we believe, as the administration has stated, that the war on terrorism is a perpetual state of affairs, or at least is likely to be an extremely long-term state of affairs, then we should be especially skeptical about efforts to restrict civil liberties, because those will not be merely short-term measures that will last during a period of time-bounded emergency. They will become permanent fixtures of the American legal, constitutional, and political system. And in that respect, we should be particularly on guard against efforts to constrain individual liberties, because they will be in place for a very long time, and that will change the very fabric of the American society.
Well, I'll tell you, we have a caller, and rather than make that person wait, why don't we go ahead and bring them into the conversation. Others certainly are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 is the number. We do also have a toll-free line, 800-222-9455. The guest in this hour, Focus 580, Jeffrey Stone. He's professor of law at the University of Chicago. And his book, by the way, if you're interested in looking at it, came out last fall. The book is titled Perilous Times, Free Speech in Wartime. It's published by Norton. Is this in paper?
Not yet.
Okay. Still in hardcover.
Right. Paper will be out in October.
All right. Here's a caller in Indiana, our line four. Hello.
Hello. Well, I was waiting for you to answer the call. You touched upon the question I'm interested in, which is during the six times that you mentioned in your book, and particularly this last sixth one, the Bush administration, can you point out if at all possible, laws or procedures or regulations or whatever the government has control to get things done that a party wanted to do, and a war came along and it opened the door for them to do what they really wanted to do before we actually had war, quote, unquote.
Well, there are many examples of that. Perhaps the clearest example of that situation was the first of the different historical periods they talk about. That was the Sedition Act of 1798. In the early years after the adoption of the American Constitution and the First Amendment, the nation was deeply polarized between the Federalists and the Republicans. The Federalists were led by John Adams and Alexander Hamilton, and the Republicans by Thomas Jefferson and James Madison. And the two parties had radically different views of what they believed to be the proper future of the United States. They were deeply distrustful of one another, and they were deeply skeptical about the ability of the new American democratic political system to survive the tensions that already had arisen. And as the election of 1800 approached, the Federalists, who until that time had controlled both the White House and the Congress for all of the prior 8 years of American history, and also had appointed all of the Federalist judges, were very anxious about what would be the likely outcome in 1800 and fearful that the Republicans might indeed win that election. In 1796, John Adams had defeated Jefferson, the Republican, by only 3 electoral votes, and so the Federalists felt themselves quite vulnerable. In that context, they took advantage of a possible war with France that loomed on the horizon to initiate the Sedition Act of 1798, which made it a criminal offense for any person to effectively criticize the president, the Congress, or the government of the United States with the intent to bring them into contempt or disrepute. The Federalists justified this legislation, which was attacked, not surprisingly, by the Republicans as a violation of the First Amendment, on the ground that in time of war, or in time of imminent war, it was essential that the nation be united. And any criticism of national leaders or national policies that would create divisions among the people would undermine the ability of the nation to fight effectively against a French enemy. And therefore, such criticism should be stifled. In fact, the underlying motivation for the Federalists in enacting the Sedition Act was to attempt to put the Republicans out of business. And indeed, the Federalists used the Sedition Act of 1798 to prosecute only members and spokesmen for the Republican Party. And the goal was to ensure the reelection of the Federalists in the election of 1800 by making it effectively impossible for the Republicans to run any kind of an effective campaign. Every major editor of a Republican newspaper was prosecuted under the act, as well as a number of prominent Republican political officers, including Congressman Matthew Lyon of Vermont, who, for example, was convicted and jailed for giving a speech in which he accused John Adams of being frivolous and to care more about pomp than about the ultimate values of the United States. So the Federalists were quite ruthless in their use of the Sedition Act. The war against France, in fact, never materialized, but the act was used exactly as the Federalists intended. The good thing about that story is that the American people were so outraged by the Sedition Act of 1798 that, in fact, they rose up and threw the Federalists out of office, elected Jefferson over Adams, and the Sedition Act of 1798 expired shortly thereafter. But that's a good example, and there are many others later in history, in which political figures took advantage of the environment created by a wartime atmosphere in an effort to enact legislation that really had an ulterior motive, which was essentially to benefit them politically, even though the apparent or the alleged justification was for the purpose of preparing the nation for war.
As I mentioned, the book deals with these six points where the government had tried to punish opposition to policy that all occurred during wartime. And in fact, if we add on the War of Terror, that would be number 7. It's one you deal with, you just sort of touch on at the end of the book. And you also say that if you take those six, you can divide them, roughly speaking, into two groups, the ones where there were more egregious and the others that were slightly less so. Acknowledging the fact we could probably talk a long time about any of these things, and you've given the thumbnail sketch of 1789. The other two that are in the examples of in the category of worst cases would be World War I and the Cold War. Maybe you can sort of do the same for those.
Sure. Well, during World War I, it's important for Americans to remember that there was a great deal of opposition to the United States' decision to enter that war. The war began in Europe in 1914, and the United States stayed out of it. Most Americans believed that whatever World War I was about, and that was itself somewhat of a mystery, they were pretty confident that it didn't threaten any vital interests of the United States. And indeed, Woodrow Wilson, as you will recall, was reelected president in 1916 specifically on the platform that he had kept us out of war. a year later, Wilson decided that it was appropriate for the United States to enter the war, primarily on the plea that the Germans, by using submarine warfare, by sinking American ships that were bringing munitions and armaments and other war supplies to Britain and France, was violating American rights under international law to freedom of the seas. And that's the basis on which he ultimately sought a declaration of war. Many Americans regarded this as not an adequate justification to go to war. For many individuals, there was the view that this was not a war to make the world safe for democracy, as Woodrow Wilson now labeled it, but rather a war to make the world safe for armaments manufacturers and munitions shippers, and that this was not enough of a good reason to jeopardize the lives of hundreds of thousands or even millions of American boys. So when war was declared, there was widespread opposition and a great deal of ambivalence to the war. And Wilson needed to respond to that. Having made the commitment to enter the war, it was essential to create a public mood that was strongly committed to carrying out the war effectively. A war demands great sacrifices on the part of individuals, and if they're going to make those sacrifices, they have to believe deeply in the cause. So to achieve that goal, Wilson essentially took two approaches. First, he created something called the Committee on Public Information, which was specifically a propaganda arm of the federal government, whose purpose it was to produce a flood of pamphlets, leaflets, speeches, editorials, movies, all of which were designed to foster a hatred of all things German and a widespread suspicion of anyone who might be thought disloyal or inadequately supportive of the war effort. And to this end, the Department of Justice fostered the development of many private organizations, such as the American Protective League, which had over 200,000 members, whose function it was to ferret out individuals who might be thought to be disloyal or not wholly supportive of the war, and to report those individuals to the Department of Justice. So on that end, the idea was to create a sense of fear and a sense of fury that would inspire people, excite people to support the war. The other challenge Wilson faced was that there were many critics of the war, and if they were not silenced, then their continued hammering away at the justice, the morality, and the justification for the war would effectively offset the efforts of the Committee on Public Information. So Wilson managed to get through Congress the Espionage Act of 1917 and the Sedition Act of 1918, which effectively, between them, again made it unlawful for any individual in the United States to criticize the government, the draft, the war, the president, the military, the Constitution, the flag, or the uniform of the military of the United States. Moreover, unlike the Sedition Act of 1798, which carried a maximum penalty of 6 months in prison, the Espionage Act and the Sedition Act during World War I carried penalties that routinely ranged from 10 to 20 years in jail. As a consequence, the administration effectively suppressed any genuine discussion of the legitimacy of World War I during the war, and put in jail and prosecuted some 2,000 dissenters, ranging in anonymity or obscurity, from the one extreme on the anonymous extreme is an example, a 20-year-old woman named Molly Steimer, who was a Russian Jewish emigre who was prosecuted for throwing leaflets in Yiddish from a rooftop in a tenement on the Lower East Side of New York, and was sentenced to 15 years in prison and was then deported to the Soviet Union. On the other extreme, on the side of prominence, Eugene Debs, who was the leader of the Socialist Party of the United States, had received 1 million votes in his campaign for president in 1912, which was 6% of all of the votes cast. He gave a speech in 1918 in Ohio in which, by innuendo, he criticized the draft and admired the courage of those who had resisted the draft. He was prosecuted, convicted, and sentenced to 10 years in prison. So it was a period of ruthless suppression of dissent, and one that was, as in the other episodes, once the war ended, viewed very quickly by the American people as a disastrous overreaction in which both many individuals suffered terribly for doing nothing more than exercising their constitutional liberties, and in which the United States essentially mutilated the thought process of the nation itself during time of war by making it impossible for people to criticize the government or the war during the time that it was being fought. The Cold War, if you'd like, To understand the Cold War and its relationship to free speech, it's important to understand, again, some of the historical context. By the late 1940s, the Democratic Party had controlled the government for the 16 preceding years. And the Republicans, particularly conservative Republicans, were very frustrated with the state of affairs and looked desperately for some way to tip the balance in national politics. One of the things that some of the particularly right-wing Republicans came upon was playing the so-called red card. And this came about in part because at the end of World War II, the United States and the Soviet Union, who had been allies during the war, quickly came to regard each other as potential enemies in the world. Americans were quickly led to fear the possibility of nuclear bombs raining down on American cities. And there were real fears of espionage and sabotage by Soviet agents in the United States. Taking their cue from this state of affairs, conservative Republicans like Richard Nixon and Joseph McCarthy essentially started making the following argument. There are members of the Communist Party, individuals who have in the past been members of the Communist Party, individuals who in the past have been affiliated with organizations that had connections to the Communist Party, riddling the federal government. There are some in the State Department. There are some in the Army. There are some in the Navy. There are some in higher education. They're in labor unions. They're in public school education. They're in the church. And they're in the media. They're in movies. And they pose a real, direct, and clear and present danger to the stability and the security of the United States. They will plot and they will plan to undermine our nation. They will steal our secrets, and they will work in cahoots with the Soviet Union when the time comes for all-out conflict with our enemies. And by hyping this fear, by exaggerating dramatically the extent to which the nation was infected with all of these insidious communist agents, and then saying, whose fault is it that we have not been adequately attentive to the risks? Whose fault is it that there are, we claim, 251 communists in the State Department? It's the Democrats. The Democrats have been soft on communism. They have allowed communists to infiltrate government at every level, to infiltrate the private industry at every level, and you can no longer trust them to protect the security of the United States. What we need to do is to put the Republicans in power, because we will be tough on communism, and we will prosecute individuals who are members of the Communist Party. We will blacklist individuals who have had ties in the past to the communists, and we will ferret them out through legislative investigations, through loyalty oaths, and exclude them from any positions of influence and authority. So, in that period, again, there were real-world events like the Korean War and the fall of China and the development of the atomic bomb by the Soviets and the real falling apart of the alliance between the United States and the Soviet Union that generated real cause for anxiety and fear on the part of the American people. But manipulative politicians saw that as an opening and used it as a way to build a level of hysteria among the American people, who were essentially told that person sitting next to you at work may be an agent of an enemy power, and you should watch him and be careful and keep track of what he does and what he says and what he reads and who he associates with and what petitions he signs and what rallies he attends, and you should report to the government any activity that might be suspicious. And what it created was an era, about 12 years of an era, of great fear and great conformity, and also a great Republican success. And so this is another illustration of a circumstance where the fact of a wartime psychology was leveraged by a political group astute enough and disingenuous enough to use it for their own political gain.
We have a caller here we will get to in just a moment, and then for anybody who might have tuned in the last a little while, I should introduce again the guest for this hour of Focus 580, Jeffrey Stone. He's a professor of law at the University of Chicago. If you'd like to read in greater depth on this subject, you should look for his book. It came out last fall. The book's titled Perilous Times, Free Speech in Wartime. It's published by Norton, which takes a look at the times, six times in American history where government moved aggressively to punish opposition to government policy. And those times are, just to recap, 1798, the Sedition Act passed under President John Adams and the Federalists. Also, Civil War, World War I and II, the Cold War, and the Vietnam War. Questions welcome here, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. This caller is in Champaign on line number one. Hello.
Yes, hi. Mm-hmm. I guess I would make 3 points. One is that I don't really think there is any significant example of any bottom-up advocacy of the kind of thing you're talking about. I think these are always elite movements to repress freedom of speech. Having said that, I would say that elites are able to draw on certain long-standing historical fears going all the way back to the Indian War era and the colonial era and the Indian Wars of that era that evoke people's fears of savagery and barbarians as, you know, as a way of sort of defending our own psyches against the fact that we were the ones being savages and we were the ones being barbaric when we evicted Indians from their land and broke treaties with them and massacred them and so forth. And the other, you know, that's sort of two separate points. But the third point that I would make is that it wasn't simply Republicans who created the Cold War hysteria after World War II. This was something willingly acted on by Democrats, by Harry Truman, by Dean Acheson, and George Kennan, who could have just as easily been a Democrat as well as a Republican, who, you know, there was a lot of controversy off Kennan's recent death, the fact that, well, he'd only been for containment and then he got out of hand and then the Red Scare. But when you look at Kennan's attitudes, he had a real contempt for the views of average people. He had a real loathing of Russia. He had a certain affinity for Nazis when he was ambassador to Germany in the 1930s. So the issue of the Cold War is really much more complicated than Republicans, you know, provoking this Red Scare. And it's even much more complicated than saying the Republicans could use that, and then Democrats kind of had to go along with that for political reasons. I mean, the origins of the Cold War are as much within Democratic politics and conservative labor politics, and you'll find just as much in terms of the background of people like Hubert Humphrey as you will find in Joseph McCarthy and some of the more conservative Republican senators.
Well, comment?
Yeah, well, sure. I mean, I think the caller is absolutely right that I was giving a very quick summary of the Cold War period, and Democrats in this era certainly joined with Republicans in some sense because they had similar fears and were concerned in the same way. In some sense, I think because they were responding to the Republicans. I think Truman, for example, when he adopted his loyalty program, was essentially attempting to preempt the Republicans from taking the initiative on the question. And rather than standing up and saying loyalty programs are not a good idea, he put in place his program in part because he wanted to defuse the argument which had been presented already by Republicans. So there was a complicated interaction between a variety of different constituencies and political forces at the time. But I would stand with the simple explanation that it was primarily utilized by Republicans to achieve political goals, and that Democrats, for the most part, were trying to fend off those attacks and essentially to out-red bait the Republicans in order to prevent the issue from becoming effective. On the question of bottom-up, I do think that there is a mixture of factors, but the best example I could think of in response to the caller's observation about the absence of repression of civil liberties that is caused by a bottom-up response would be the Japanese internment. There, I think that it was clearly a hysterical demand from people on the West Coast, prompted by a variety of factors, that ultimately brought to Franklin Roosevelt's desk the draft of Executive Order 9066 that resulted in the internment of 120,000 individuals of Japanese descent. two-thirds of whom were American citizens. This was not an instance where it was the White House or even the military who actually wanted to engage in this policy because of a decision that it served national interest or even partisan political interest. It was really much more a set of demands from the local constituency that ultimately led the administration to acquiesce, again, in part for political reasons, in part because Roosevelt did not want to alienate so many individuals on the West Coast who were now demanding the internment of the Japanese. But I think that is an instance where the government acted more in response to a popular demand than dictated the situation from
Could
a top
I respond
down.
To that?
Yeah, sure.
I guess I think that case is on a different order than simply, repression of freedom of speech and so forth. Obviously, to inter people is on a different order of magnitude in terms of this. And I don't know the research in this area in terms of what provoked it, but I suspect that a good hypothesis would be that the hysteria that Professor Stone refers to was a hysteria propagated by elite individuals in California. That it was not, that the average person wouldn't have even dreamed of interring Japanese unless via LA Times or other elite institutions. I'm not sure what the LA Times role was this. I suspect, having grown up in LA, that they had something to do with creating this hysteria, and certainly the LA Times didn't represent the average person. So I would put that in doubt. Without knowing all the arguments there, I really would not assume at all that it was anything that Roosevelt was responding to, anything other than economic and political elites in California.
I guess this depends on how we define top down and bottom up. My view in this instance is bottom up meant that it was a local constituency demanding something, whereas you're focusing more on who among the local constituency was doing the demanding.
Well, yeah, but you can't just say it's bottom up because it's people living in California. I mean, there's elites in California too. I mean, it just doesn't make your case. I hate to debate a lawyer for crying out loud, but it doesn't make your case to say that just because they weren't Washington officials that makes it bottom up.
Well, fair enough. Anything else before we go on?
No, that's fine.
Right. Those are great comments. Thank you.
Well, I appreciate the call. And, of course, other people who are listening are welcome to call, too. And the number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. As I mentioned that in your book, you say you can roughly group these six according to worst case and least worst case, and that the worst were the Sedition Act, 1789, what happened in World War I and the Cold War, and the others being Civil War, World War II, Vietnam. The thing that you say makes the difference between the two is the extent to which the national leadership intentionally fanned the flames of public anger and fear and directed it against their opponents, and that contributed both to the degree of public hysteria and to the repression of dissent. Given that, I wonder what makes the difference between these two groups, because they're certainly all scattered out in time. Does it have something to do with the motivation of the political leadership, who those people are? Does it say something about the time, something about how it is that people perceived, what sort of dangers they perceived there were? What really is the difference between the first three and the second three?
I think they're primarily political judgments about whether an all-out effort to repress dissent will play an important role in serving the political interests of the leadership. So in the Civil War, for example, Lincoln, for the most part, was himself quite tolerant of criticism. And the level of vituperation directed against Lincoln during the Civil War is unparalleled in American history in terms of criticism of a sitting president. And Lincoln, I think, tolerated that in part perhaps because of whatever views he may have held about democracy and free speech, but primarily because the political situation was such was that he desperately needed to keep the border states. And the border states, if they found themselves being citizens in the border states found themselves being ruthlessly suppressed, and their criticism of Lincoln's policies would have been much less likely to stay with the Union and to be supportive of the Union. So I think practical realities shaped that. Also, the Republican Party had made its name in large part in defense of free speech because of their challenges to the Southern anti-abolitionist speech in the years leading up to the Civil War. And so they had a definition as a political party that made them more committed to the principle of free speech. In World War II, of course, there was relatively little opposition to the United States policies in the war, although there was a great deal of disagreement about whether the United States should be seeking to enter the war before Pearl Harbor. After Pearl Harbor, that disagreement essentially disappeared because the nation had been attacked. And although there were a small number of dissidents during World War II, primarily individuals who were fascists or identified with the Nazi Party or with the general view of fascism, they tended to be very few and far between. They were suppressed, in fact. But there were so few of them that it didn't make any sense to turn this into a large issue of government policy. And during the Vietnam War, I think the problem was twofold. First, we had made some progress in our appreciation of these values, both in our legal system and, I believe, in our culture. The idea in 1968 that it would have been thinkable for the United States government to prosecute Eugene McCarthy for his criticism of the war in a way analogous to the prosecution of Gene Debs in World War I or Clement Vallandigham during the Civil War, who was a leader of the Peace Democrats who was prosecuted and convicted for criticizing the administration, or in the way Congressman Matthew Lyon was in 1798. By 1968 or by 2004, the idea of prosecuting Howard Dean for his criticism of the war in Iraq would have been quite shocking to the American people. So the government in the Vietnam War attempted to use more insidious means of undermining dissent. And examples of that would have been prosecutions for activities that were closely tied to individuals engaged in the anti-war movement. So prosecutions for burning a draft card, for burning a flag, for using profanity in public were ways of getting at those individuals who were protesting the war without literally prosecuting them for criticizing the government. In addition, of course, the FBI put into place its counterintelligence programs, COINTELPRO, which was a vast undercover surveillance network designed to expose, disrupt, and neutralize the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement by investigating those organizations, creating files on over 500,000 Americans because of their political beliefs and activities, and then using that information in a wide variety of ways in order to punish or to disadvantage them through the IRS, by sending anonymous letters to their schools if they were students, to their parents if they were young, to their spouses if they were married, making all sorts of accusations designed to make it more difficult for them to continue in their lives as dissenters. So the government shifted its mechanism during the Johnson and particularly Nixon administrations with respect to suppressing free speech. But they could not attack it as directly as it was attacked during the prior episodes.
I probably should introduce again our guest. We have about 15 minutes left. We're talking this morning with Jeffrey Stone. He's professor of law at the University of Chicago and talking about free speech in wartime. That's the subject of his recent book, Perilous Times, published by W.W. Norton. Questions, comments, welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. I want to come to where it is we are now. And certainly there has been since September 11th, when we have been in this period that people have called the war on terror, concerns about the erosion of civil liberties, particularly when it comes to government surveillance and collecting information about people and things like wiretaps, things like executing searches of people's homes when they're not there and not notifying them until afterwards, if at all. How do you think that we are doing now, particularly when it comes to this issue, and that is the ability of people to criticize government and government policy?
Those who have said that we are now living in the most repressive period of American history know really nothing about American history. And one of the reasons why I wanted to write this book was both to understand those episodes as a way of helping to enable Americans to think more clearly about the present, and that also includes thinking about how you put it in perspective. And so I would say that measured against those other historical periods, we are not living in an era at the moment in which repression of free speech in any way really compares to what existed in those other periods. On the other hand, and although that is something we should be proud of, we should also recognize that this is fragile and that we have fortunately have no attacks since 9/11 on American soil. And if we imagine what would be going on in the United States if we had had 6 or 10 9/11 type attacks over a period of months or weeks after 9/11, it's easy to understand that our mindset would be completely different from what it is at the moment, where most of us feel relatively secure that these are going to be few and far between and perhaps something we can even eventually live with at a certain minimal level. But if you imagine that we had had a succession of attacks and they had every reason to continue in the future, the types of policies we would be thinking about and indeed most of us would be supporting are far more draconian than anything that's been put in place. Hmm. Having said that, I also think it's important to note that I believe that this administration has followed a pattern that is similar to the pattern that's existed in the past. And by that I mean both that it has leveraged the situation for partisan political gain and that it has put in place a number of mechanisms that are careless about the potential impact on free speech. And when one thinks about how much freedom of speech we have, it's important to recognize that free speech can be squelched in many different ways. The most effective and the most dramatic way of undermining it is to make it a crime, is to simply say it is unlawful to criticize the government. And that's certainly what has happened in many of these prior episodes. But there are other ways of having a very substantial impact on free speech. The second most important way that government can do this is simply by making people aware that if they say certain things, join certain organizations, participate in certain demonstrations, that they may run some risks in terms of files being created on them, in terms of disadvantages they may suffer, whether they even know or don't know that those things are happening to them. Their employment might be jeopardized. And the difficulty with surveillance is that speech is very precarious. Each of us knows, when we think about it, that the extent to which we have the ability to actually affect national government policy by the act of signing a petition or marching in a demonstration or reading a certain book or going to a certain lecture is infinitesimally small. And if we know that there is some risk, not just that we might be prosecuted and go to jail for 10 to 20 years, but even a risk that we may wind up in an FBI file as someone who is a suspected sympathizer with organizations that are later found to be involved with terrorist actions, then we may think twice about whether we will sign that petition or whether we will participate in that demonstration. And it doesn't take a draconian measure to deter people from exercising their rights. And even though the loss of any one voice in that context may be important to the person, but not ultimately important to the total scope of public debate, if each of millions of individuals suffers that same chilling effect, then we do have a corruption of the thinking process of the entire community. And so the wide variety of investigative mechanisms that this administration has put into place to enable it to find out about the views, the attitudes, the associates, the reading that is done by ordinary American citizens does pose a significant risk of eventually, if not already, being perceived by people as an implicit threat that if they, in fact, take strong positions or public positions on any of these sorts of issues that is incompatible with the goals of the government, that it may come back at some point in the future when they're applying for a job or applying for school to haunt them. And that can have a dramatic impact on public discourse.
We have a couple of callers here. We'll try to get them in the time that remains. Next is someone in Urbana, and it's line one. Hello.
Yeah, we have a revolutionary war dating back over two centuries ago. We have several wars in the 19th century, and then two huge wars, and several smaller ones since then. How would you say it's been changing as far as the controls on free speech from beginning to end? Is it increasing or decreasing, or more free or less free?
A lot of it is fact-based on the nature, severity of the war, and of the nature of the perceived threat. But I tend to be an optimist, and my view is that we have a stronger understanding of the importance of civil liberties in our legal system and among our population than we have had in most of our history, that Americans are more conscious of being proud of the fact that this is a nation that respects civil liberties as an important part of its culture and values, and that that does play a salutary role in limiting what government would be tempted to do. So to give a couple of positive illustrations, during the last several years, the Bush administration floated a number of programs that it was contemplating putting into place, such as the TIPS program that Attorney General John Ashcroft was considering, that was designed to enlist American citizens in reporting information to the Department of Justice about individuals who the individual citizens, might have thought were disloyal or sympathetic to terrorists, quite reminiscent of some of the practices that were put in place during World War I. And there was an outcry of protest against that proposal, and it was dropped. Similarly, the administration was thinking of putting in place a total information awareness program under the leadership of John Poindexter. And the idea there was to create massive data gathering upon every routine activity of American citizens so that the government could know what everyone bought, where they were, where they traveled, what they spent their money on, what movies they saw, all in a massive data set that would help them put together patterns and discern connections that are very subtle between American citizens that might be able to identify possible terrorists. And again, there was a widespread opposition to this as very dangerous to civil liberties. William Safire, you might remember, wrote several very powerful columns protesting this, and it was dropped. And, of course, Patriot Act II was floated by the administration, which contained a number of much more aggressive policies than Patriot Act I. And when there was large opposition to that, it was dropped at the time. So I do think that the American people are more sensitive to these issues, more attentive to these questions than they have been in the past, and that one of the things we need to do in a very self-conscious way if we want to preserve our freedom even in times of crisis is to instill in younger citizens the knowledge and the values about what it means to be a responsible citizen in a self-governing society, and that the relationship between the citizen and the government officials is that the citizen is, in fact, the governor, and that the public officials are working for the citizens. That's a very critical line, and sometimes we've forgotten it, and when we forget it, we get in very serious trouble.
I want to thank the caller and hope he won't mind if I go on try to get at least one more person in Champaign. This is line number two. Hello.
Yes, I called in just when you were saying that things were not as bad as they have ever been before, and then I was wanting you to go on and say what you did say, but maybe you could go into it in more detail about what is the current status with the Patriot Act. It seems to me like the power of it has been increased either through legislation or other kinds of, unseen kinds of decisions being made that don't seem to be on the public radar. And can you tell us then about what kind of data is being kept on American citizens?
And unfortunately, I can only give you about a minute to do that because we're just about out of time.
One great problem we have at the moment is this administration has, I said before, there were many ways in which public discourse can be impaired. And one of the things that the Bush administration has done more effectively than any of its predecessors is to use secrecy as a way of diffusing effective dissent. It is difficult to criticize in a responsible manner if you simply don't have adequate information upon which to base criticism. And this administration has been remarkably aggressive about denying the public information that is important to public debate, and denying it not because of national security reasons, but because the government does not want there simply to be debate on those questions. And a good illustration of this is the question that the caller just raised about how often is the government, in fact, engaging in surveillance and infiltration on individuals and on groups? What kind of data is being gathered? What's being done with that data? With whom is it being shared? To what extent is the government gaining data from commercial suppliers and vendors, and thereby circumventing limitations in what the government itself can do? The problem is that the government has not been forthcoming at all in its willingness to reveal that information, and that's one of the most important challenges that we face at the moment. A secret government is not compatible with a democracy. And what we have at present is a government that is trying to be as much of a secret government as it possibly can be.
Well, there, I'm sorry to say, we will have to stop because we have used our time. If you'd like to read more on the subject, again, look for the book that we've been talking about here. It's titled Perilous Times, Free Speech in Wartime, published by W.W. Norton, by our guest, Jeffrey Stone, who is the Harry Calvin Jr. Distinguished Service Professor of Law at the University of Chicago. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me.